Okay, so today we're going to start by talking about basic psychology, looking at action, perception, and cognition in humans. And of course, if you want to create interactive systems, you need to know how...
Bonjour, je sais pas si ça va être mon goût.
Merci. Il n'y a pas de bus.
Il n'y a pas de bus. Des supélecs, ils vont prendre ton commun.
Ouais. So if you want to create interactive systems, of course, you have to know about computers and you have to know about humans. So I'm not a psychologist, so I'm just going to give you some very basic things. One thing that is particularly important in interactive system is the notion of coupling between action, perception, cognition. Usually it goes from perception, you perceive things in the world, you process your things in your mind, and then you make a plan and you act in the world by speaking or by using your hands or by moving yourself. And those actions, of course, affect the outside world and your perception, and there is this loop between perception, cognition, and action. In classical psychology, these things tend to be studied very independently. And we know a lot of things about perception in particular and visual perception. What I want to emphasize here is the importance of the coupling between action and perception. The first way this coupling works is that oftentimes you need to act in order to perceive. So, for example, the perception of depth, how far an object is from me, is done first because we have binocular vision, so we have two eyes. So the two eyes see something a bit different, and our brain can reconstruct that in a 3D object. But this only works for, you know, things that are close to us. For things that are far away, the difference between the images is too small. So the way we perceive depth for distant objects is by moving the head. So I do an action, moving my head. When I move my head, I can tell that the objects closer to me move faster than those further away. So I can decide which is in front of which. Right? So if I, well, we don't have a good scene here, but if you look outside, I can tell this tree is in front of this one because of the way they move. Another example is if I ask you to close your eyes, put your hand, and I put an object in your hand, it's very hard to detect what is this object. If you are able to touch the object, to manipulate it, to act on it, then you can usually recognize what kind of object it is. So we need, in many cases, we need action for perception. It's true with hearing as well. To locate the origin of a sound, if we turn our head, we can see, we can better perceive where it comes from. But of course, we also need perception for action, and for every gesture that we make, usually it's guided by our perception of the world. So if I try to grab this bottle here, I have to look at it, and usually my vision is going to guide my gesture. Now, for an object that is big enough and that is at arm's length, I can close my eyes and do it. But in general, I need perception for action. And so in user interfaces, this is very important to understand the link between action and perception. And we will talk a lot about the notion of feedback, what the systems gives you in terms of information when you interact with it. And feedback is very important because we are used in the real world to have feedback, to have these perception-action loops. So, in psychology, there has been several movements over the history of psychology. And, for example, in until the 60s, 70s, behavioral psychology was very predominant. And behavioral psychology was about observing the behavior of animals, including humans, but animals in general, and learning how to shape this behavior. And for example, behavioral techniques are used today when you train animals. The Pavlov effect is sort of typical of this kind of work. So the goal of behavioral psychology was not necessarily to explain how the brain works, but to observe correlations between the behavior that you observe and how the behavior changes depending on the stimulus you give to the animals. So it is extremely effective, but it's essentially, it is descriptive and it is predictive. With animals, you can train animals to do amazing things through behavioral techniques. But it doesn't say anything about why it works, how it works. So from the 70s more and more in the 80s and 90s, there has been another movement called cognitive psychology that has become predominant. And the goal in cognitive psychology was really to try to understand how the brain works. And this is still a very strong movement currently. We're still doing yesterday's slides, but yes. You can take those.
Okay. That's
right. So in cognitive psychology, it's really centered around what is the brain, how the brain works, how does it function. And it is not so much interested, unfortunately, in action and perception, the input and output, if you wish. If you were comparing with a computer, it's trying to understand how the computer works, not how it can communicate with the outside world. And so we are very far, of course, from understanding things like memory or planning or things like this. But through imaging technology, people start to have some ideas of how the brain may work. This slide is about a third sort of movement that was started by a psychologist called James Gibson, also after the wars in the 50s and 60s. And I like this approach because it is putting more emphasis on the perception and the action. And the theory behind what Gibson calls the ecological theory of perception is that, and that's what the ecological term means, is that animals have evolved over the course of evolution together with their environment. So the animals, the environment, of course, shapes the animals, and the animals shape the environment. So there are animals that modify the environment to make it adapted to the way they live and they behave. And so what Gibson says is, in fact, this co-adaptation has happened including to shape our senses, our perceptual senses. It is quite extraordinary that all animals that have eyes, the eyes are essentially the same. In particular, they see pretty much the same slice of bandwidth, you know, in the huge bandwidth that you could see from you know, very low frequencies, infrared to X-rays. We all see things in between like 240 and 480 nanometers, I think, something like this. So all animals who have eyes perceive, have vision in that spectrum. And probably it is because it's there that there are interesting things to see in the world if you are to survive in the world. And so Gibson came up with this notion that our senses, our perceptual senses, directly pick up information. And the way this works, and he's done a lot of work on visual perception, is by saying that what we perceive are not images. Our eye is not a little camera that takes, you know, whatever, 20, 50, 60 images per second, and then our brain is doing, you know, image processing. His theory is that what we really perceive is optical flows, things that change, And in particular, what we are very good at is at extracting invariance from these optical flows. And this image here, that is the cover of his main book, illustrates this. Imagine you are a bird and you're flying over the ocean. So imagine how things move around you. When you move, there are things on the side that go by quickly. And then things that are more in the direction where you're moving move more slowly. So this is what these arrows show here. And in fact, the only point that is invariant is the one towards which you are going. Right? So if you could imagine being this bird, or you can make the experiment yourself walking, the only things that will move is the direction where you're going. And this is always true even if you change direction. So he showed various invariants of that sort. Another one that is very famous is the one that allows you to catch, if I throw a ball at you, how do you catch that ball? Well, you know, cognitivists would probably start saying, well, your brain evaluates the direction, the velocity, all the parameters, and then you make some computation in your brain that tells you that you have to go there. And Gibson says it doesn't work like this. There is a very simple way to make sure that you will intercept the ball if you can intercept it, if you can move fast enough. And the way to make sure you do that is you only need to know the instantaneous direction of motion of the ball. And so if you maintain a fixed angle between your angle of motion and the perceived velocity, you will either intercept the ball or miss it because you couldn't move fast enough anyway to catch it. And so some people have run experiments that confirm this with you know, the way not only humans but dogs go after a ball. And what is very interesting about this theory is that it's very economical. You don't need to make many hypotheses about what you are able to perceive or what the brain is able to do. If you find the right invariant, then the solution is very simple. You don't need to have lots of hypotheses about how things work. So this ecological theory from Gibson also is used in the context of HCI, because Gibson introduced something that is a very difficult concept to grasp, that is called affordances. And it's really this notion of information pickup here, is that our senses, you know, we are inundated by data coming through our ears, through our eyes, through our touch. So we have to filter this data. And how it gets filtered is because we only extract the information that is meaningful to us. Right? So the notion of affordance is the idea that the animal in general, because this theory is not just for humans, so animals in general, humans in particular, can detect affordances in the real world for things they are trying to do. So if I'm trying to, you know, get up because I want to grab a fruit on a tree, for example, I will look in the environment for things that allow me to get up. So if I'm out in the in the wild, I will look for a rock maybe, or something that I can climb on. If I'm in a room, I will see a chair, and even though a chair is not normally used to get up, it's used for sitting, I will detect that it has the right height relative to me that I can actually climb on it. And some experiments that have been done with that involve openings. We immediately perceive whether an opening in a wall allows us to get through it or is too small for us to go through it. And so this affordance of passing is something that we sort of built in, if you want to view it this way. So this notion of affordances, it's a concept that is difficult to grasp, because it seems like you're giving the solution with the problem. But in fact, it's a very powerful concept, and we see all the time that unconsciously or subconsciously, we are aware of what the environment has to offer to us for a certain action. So if I'm trying to write, for example, I'm again out in the wild, I don't have a pencil or anything, maybe I will pick a piece of wood and I will write in the sand or on the ground. Or maybe I made a fire and I can use a burned piece of wood to use the charcoal from the wood to write. If I'm in a room, I will look for a piece of paper, I will look for a pencil, and once I have a pencil or a pen, I know I can write. And I can write on paper, but I can write also on the table, I can write on the wall. Then there are social rules that also tell me maybe to not do that. But it's a very powerful way of thinking that objects in the world, in fact, empower us, give us ways to do things that we couldn't do without them. And I think this is very relevant to human-computer interaction, because what we're trying to build with computers is sophisticated tools to let us do things that we couldn't do without the computers. But thinking in terms of affordances, how can these tools help us to achieve particular tasks, and how can users immediately perceive that when I see this on the screen and I know I can enter text or I can draw or I can do this other thing, means that you essentially don't need any learning because things are immediately perceived. And so Don Norman is a psychologist who has taken this notion of affordances and moved them in the world of human-computer interaction, moving from Gibson-like affordances, which are immediately perceived and probably are built into our brains, to what Don Norman calls cognitive affordances, cultural affordances, which are learned with time. Because when we grew up, we learned a lot of things about how the technological world around us works. And so you can use the same concept of affordance to understand how people interact with technology. So I encourage you to look into James Gibson. His writings are not easy to read and to understand, but it's very... I think it's very profound.
Sorry.
Yes.
Would you spell the word affordances?
I don't know if that is. So affordance is called. It's A F F O R D A N C E, like that. Like it's a word that, in fact, when I teach in French, I use the same word because it doesn't have a good translation. In English, to afford, when I say I can afford something, it's usually I have enough money to buy it. But I can afford to quit my job, or I can. I have the power to do something, the ability to do something, and so an affordance is something in the world that I perceive as giving me the ability to do something. Okay, so I will go faster on the slides here, which just give you a little bit of data about our senses. In more, this is what you find in any classic book on psychology. So psychology has studied vision and sight a lot, partly because it's a dominant sense for humans. So we have a visual field that is fairly large, close to 180 degrees. In fact, in this field of vision, we have what's called the focus of attention. It's also called the fovea. And it is the a part in the middle of our visual field where our acuity is much higher. So we can perceive objects that are, four hundredths of a millimeter at about 50 centimeters. So that gives you typically the maximal resolution that is useful on the screen. If you go beyond that, your eye won't see it. So, for example, this is why the iPhone 4 they have this screen called the Retina display, because they have a resolution which is close to 300 pixels per inch, that is close to this. Now, of course, we also see in the periphery, but what happens is as you move towards the periphery, you are less sensitive to colors and more sensitive to motion. So for example, the visual field of 180 degrees, if you try this experiment where you put your hands like this, and you know you should see your two hands if you had a field of 180 degrees, well, if you don't move your hands, you probably won't see it. But you realize that if you move your hands, then you can... So if I start here and I open this, so about here, I don't see my hands anymore. But if I move, I can see them up to here. So we are most sensitive to motion in the periphery. Now there's an evolutionary explanation for this, is that you know if you imagine you're out there in the jungle and there are predators, you know it's more interesting to see that something is jumping at you than to see what color it is. So, but another way also to see that is that if you're looking at the tree and there is a bird in the tree, it's very hard to see the bird. But when the bird flies away, you immediately see it. So there are lots of known things about the perception of color, the perception of motion, the perception of depth. There are a lot of things that we don't really understand that well, including in color, motion, and depth. But the important things for when you create user interfaces is this notion of acuity. Things about perception of color, designing things also knowing that there is a fraction of the population, about 10%, who is colorblind, one way or the other. So doesn't see differences between certain colors. And also in terms of motion, you need to have at least 10 images per second in an animation for the fusion to occur and for it to be perceived as motion instead of step animations. And of course, movies, for example, and TV runs at about 25 to 30 images per second. And it's often said that you know it's the right value. But our eye can perceive a lot more than that. And if you've seen, there are places where you can see high-speed movies. For example, in France, in the Futuroscope in Poitiers, they have various technologies, and one of them is, I cannot remember the name, for high-speed, so 60 images per second movies that are shot, of course, with special cameras. And so what happens is that your eye can perceive this 60 images per second, and if you compare with the same movie shot at 30 images per second, it will look more blurry. So our eye is making this trade-off between sort of blurring things or seeing them sharper depending on the speed. But we are very sensitive to motion. So hearing... Hearing is less well studied, but still has been the topic of a lot of research. Like, I didn't say that for sight, but it's also true for hearing. There is a very large sensitivity range. In terms of hearing, you can hear a very tiny sound of, you know, a leaf falling off a tree, up to, you know, very loud sounds like a plane taking off. Before your eyes get, in fact, injured. And this is true of hearing, of sight. We can see very in very low light and also in very bright light. And our eye can adjust better than pretty much any camera for which you need to, you know, change sensitivity of your sensor or use other ways. So with sight, we can close our eyes and stop seeing, but of course we cannot do that with our ears. So we always hear things, and sometimes we can listen to, and sometimes we just hear without trying to listening. And there is a well-known effect called the cocktail party effect, where you can actually focus your ears on a conversation. So it's called the cocktail party effect because you imagine a cocktail party with groups of people talking. And in fact, you can focus your hearing onto one group versus the other. And this is an effect that is not understood. We don't know how the ear can do this. The ear plus the brain, because you know it's getting the same signal and is being able to extract different things. The other thing we know about hearing is the masking effects. So two sounds can hide each other if they come from places that are close. So there is a separation effect. And also if their loudest frequencies are close. And so you all know the MP3 format for music. So what MP3 does, and the reason why it's so good at compressing sound signal, is because it's using our characteristics of our ears. And so, for example, it knows that when these masking effects are in play, it can remove part of the sound because it knows that the human ear won't hear it. So we can also hear the source, the localization in 3D of a source. And this is a case where our vision is also very good at localizing things. And so you have what is called the multimodal perception, where if you see someone sing and hear the sound of her voice, then you immediately fuse those signals and you interpret it as it is this person singing. And this is true even if you are at a concert and the sound is actually coming out of the of the loudspeakers. But to you, because you see the person singing, it looks like it comes from her. And so there is it's a sort of masking effect again, where in fact the visual signal is masking what the ear tells you. And there are experiments that have tried to look at these things. Then there is touch. So touch is a very rich and complicated sense. In fact, it's several senses together. If you look at the skin, there are six types of sensors in your skin. There are different sensors for hot, and cold. And there is yet another sensor for pain. And of course, very hot can be pain. there are sensors for pressure. And in fact, there are three types of sensors for pressure and touch that have different sensitivities. So, for example, we have different sensors for very light touch compared to harder contact. So, touch in itself, the notion of touch, is rich. You have this notion of pressure, the temperature, and pain. But what we call touch is not just that. It also usually includes what's called proprioception. So proprioception is our knowledge of how our body is in the world. So you don't have to look at yourself to know that you're standing or sitting or lying down. So how does this happen? I mean, we are so used to it that it doesn't seem to even be a problem. But how does our brain know that, you know, my arm is lifted or down? So, in fact, in the joints, there are sensors that tell the brain how my body is configured. And I was talking before about, you know, putting an object in your hand and you touching it to discover what it is. Part of this will be touch, that will tell you about the texture, maybe the if it's hot or cold. And then there's a part that is proprioception that will allow your brain to reconstruct the shape of the objects from the configuration of your hand. So that is the second part of the, what is called touch. And then there's a third one, which is kinesthesia, which is the perception of the force that is created by our muscles. So again, if I put an object in your hand, it has a certain weight. So you have to counteract this weight with your muscles. And again, there are sensors in the muscles that tell you how much force they're applying, so you can evaluate the weight of something or the resistance of an object that you're trying to push. So sometimes the touch is called TPK, or tactilo-proprio-kinesthetic, which is a very fancy name. And in human-computer interaction, people have used interfaces that use kinesthesia with force feedback. So for example, in games, you have some joysticks that have force feedback. But in virtual reality, and you'll see that in the other class, there's a lot of devices that have been created to allow you to virtually touch objects through kinesthetic feedback. And there has been a few things done on touch, trying to have a system give you tactile feedback. For example, the different types of surfaces, so you can distinguish. Our touch sense is amazing. I mean, I can distinguish that this is paper and this is the surface of the table. This is something that is underused in today's interfaces. And I'm sure there are prototypes, for example, of systems like smartphones, where the screen, in fact, can give you different touch feedback. So when you touch an object, it could be rough or smooth or bubbly or something. So that is for touch. And then, of course, there are things I am not talking about: smell and taste, because some people have done research on using smell and taste in interfaces, but it's not really mainstream at the moment. There's another sense that we often forget, is the sense of balance. So you know, in the inner ear, you have special sensors that tell you that you are standing vertical, that allow you to maintain your stance and not fall when you walk or when you're on a bike. And that's also something that tells us about our body in the world. So it could be part of proprioception. Okay, so now we turn to the motor system and how do we act in the world. So essentially we act in the world in two ways. One is through voice. And humans are especially good at that, although of course animals use communication with sounds as well. But I can be very effective with voice. I can say, get out of here, and I can move you all out of the room just with my voice. So it's a powerful way to act in the world. The other way, of course, is through our motor system and our ability to reach objects and touch them, carry them, break them, move them, etc. So in the context of graphical user interfaces, something that is very important is the ability to designate objects on the screen. So it's often called pointing. It's also called targeting, reaching a target. And it's one of the few places where psychology gives us a formula, a mathematical formula, the equivalent of a law in physics. So this law is called Fitt's law. I will get back to it in more detail in the class on pointing and navigation. It's called Fitt's law because it was discovered by Paul Fitt in 1954, and he was not working with computers at all. He was working with subjects, giving them a table where there were these two marks on the table, and they were asked to tap alternatively between those two targets as fast as they could. In fact, what happened is this pencil here was metallic pencil, and these marks on the table were also metal strips, so he could record precisely when they were touching the sides, because it would close a circuit every time they would touch. And so he ran experiments where he was varying the width of the target and the amplitude, which is the distance between the targets. And so intuitively, if I ask you to do this task, which is tap, 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 if I make the targets further away, so if I make the amplitude larger, are you going to go faster?
No.
No. Okay, so if it's farther away, it will take more time. Now, if I make the targets smaller, will you go faster?
No,
because you need more precision. Well, the thing is, how exactly slower are you going to be every time I change the distance? Well, he came up with this law where the movement time, mt, is a linear function. A is a constant, plus b is a constant, times something he calls the index of difficulty of the task. And the index of difficulty is this logarithm of 1 plus d over w. And you're thinking, where on earth did he get that? Well, the thing is, from what we said, if the distance or the amplitude here gets larger, then, of course, this will get larger, so the time will get larger. On the other hand, if the width gets smaller, then for the same d over w becomes larger, and again, the time grows. But what this tells me is something a lot more interesting, which is that if I divide the distance by 2, it's the same thing as if I increase the width by 2. Right? Now, A and B, where do they come from here? Well, these constants depend on the subject, although across able subjects, subjects that do not have disabilities or problems, motor problems, A and B are fairly consistent. They can also depend on the apparatus you're using. And in fact, a lot of research in human-computer interaction has gone around using this as a research tool. So for example, people have compared A and B for pointing in the real world on the table, like in the original experiment, to pointing with a mouse on the screen, to pointing with a trackpad, to pointing with a joystick, to pointing with anything you can imagine. And in fact, you can use the values of A and B in those different situations to see which device is more efficient than the other. So it's a very simple formula, but very powerful, and it has really, there are hundreds and hundreds of papers, articles in the literature that have worked around Fitt's law to use it to understand something very simple, which is pointing on the screen. But the thing is, we don't point on the screen any faster than we point in the real world. And so usually computers, you know, are supposed to make us more efficient. But for something as simple as pointing, the problem is the computer cannot really help us. You know, we still have to do the pointing. We will see techniques, and in fact, I think I have some in the slides today, where you can get a little bit better, but you still have a limitation. And in fact, there is an interesting theoretical background behind this formula, which has to do with information theory. And I don't know if you know Shannon's theory, Claude Shannon. Shannon invented the notion of information, or at least formalized the notion of information in the 40s at Bell Labs. And he was studying, you know, how can you optimize transferring information on wires for the telephone system. He was working for AT&T, the American telephone company. And so he discovered this law of the maximum capacity of a channel where there is noise on the channel. And in fact, the formula that he has is extremely similar to this one, where the maximum capacity is a function of the logarithms of the signal over the noise. And here, when I'm asking a subject to tap these two targets alternatively, I'm trying to, an interpretation is, I'm trying then to send a signal which is really tapping the target as precisely as possible in the middle, but there is some noise in the system which makes them point a little bit on the side. And so there is a very strong relationship between information theory in the Shannon way and Fitts' law here, which gives us a way to look at a pointing task. And in fact, you can interpret the B constant here as the bandwidth of the channel between me and the system, because when I'm pointing at something on the screen, I'm communicating information to the computer. If I have 100, you know, icons on my screen and I say, I click this one, I'm communicating information that it is this one I want and not any of the 99 other ones. So that's where things get, I think, very interesting in that they link two areas that were completely separate. So in the motor system, the other thing I want to talk briefly about is Yves Guillard's theory on bimanual control. Yes?
I have a question. The A and B values depend on which end and, we use for pointing the condition. With one eye, it's more difficult.
It certainly depends on the hand. Your non-dominant hand is going to be probably less accurate. I don't know that they have tested this with one eye versus two eyes. So it's an interesting idea. If you talk to Yves Guillard, who's a French psychologist who's done a lot of work in this area, this thing, you know, Fitts' law can be seen in a lot of things that are not pure pointing. So what he told me once is, if you play a sound, a pitch, a note, and you ask someone to whistle and to reach that pitch with certain precision, he predicted that you would get the same formula here. So this notion, in fact, that you have this information processing loops that take place and that they are sort of governed by this Shannon equation is something that, you know, is not just a particular feature of our hand and eye for this particular task. It's a lot more general. I don't know if that answers your question. So one thing that Yves Guillard works on is looking also at how people use two hands in their everyday tasks. And oftentimes, when people use two hands, it is seen as there is one bad hand and one good hand. Right hand, if you're right-handed, is your good hand, and the left hand is just not as good. And what he said is, no, this is not the way to look at it. In fact, our two hands are very able, but not at the same things. And even though they look remarkably similar, they do different things. And so, in his theory, the non-dominant hand is usually used first to establish the context in which the dominant hand, so the right hand for a right-handed person, will operate. And so, for example, there's an experiment where you give a sheet of paper to people in the room, and half of them, you ask them to keep their other hand in the back and to write on the sheet of paper, and you do a dictation, so you tell them something and they have to write it. And so one half can use both hands, and the other half can use only one hand. And so what you realize is, first, that those who use two hands can do it better and more quickly. And what they do is, as they write, their left hand, again, if they are right-handed, so their non-dominant hand moves the sheet around, so the right hand is always in the most efficient place to write. And so what he did was to actually use a carbon copy page, so he could see what was written on the page, but he could also see in the reference of the table. And what was clear is that people who write a full page on the table, in fact, it's about 10 lines because they were using this adjusting. And so if you look at many tasks, like using a ruler to draw a line, but all the things like cooking, where usually it's your left hand that holds the pan and the right hand that puts the ingredient or stirs, or that's the more precise task. So his theory is that the non-dominant hand is used first. It sets the context. It doesn't need to have the same level of precision of the dominant hand. And then the dominant hand acts second within that context. And we'll see later on a number of systems, computer systems, that have been built using these principles. And for example, inspired by the way people use not only rulers, but other tools to draw, which is typically a bimanual task. Okay, now we turn to the brain. And there are so many things we do not know about the brain that I'm not even sure that the things we know are that accurate. So I will concentrate on two small parts. Well, small parts, no, in themselves they are huge, but I will talk briefly about two aspects. One is memory, the other is learning, which are very important, again, when you study a human-computer interaction. So memory, in short, we have different types of memory. And the very simplest way to describe it is that we have short-term and long-term memory. Now, in fact, there are things in between, so it is a lot more complicated. But the short-term memory is the working memory, where we keep a few number of things, 7 plus or minus 2, a few number of items for a short amount of time, 10 to 30 seconds. So imagine I give you a phone book, I ask you to find a phone number, you have to find it, then memorize it and go dial it on the phone that is in the other room. So a phone number in France is 10 digits. So we are sort of at the limit of this. And so how are you going to do this task? How are you going to remember the phone number?
I repeat the number
in. Exactly. And in fact, what happens is, because the short-term memory is short-lived, the way to make things stay is by re-inputting them. And so by repeating it in your head, you are in fact sort of rereading it. And this is also the mechanism by which items in the short-term memory move to long-term memory. If they are repeated enough, you end up remembering them for good. And long-term memory has infinite capacity and limited duration. Well, of course, unlimited duration is limited by the fact that we die one day or the other, so I don't know what happens to memory after that, but And the infinite capacity, what it means is that the problem with memory is not to that memories get away, it's that we lose access to it. And accessing things, especially in long-term memory, is done in an associated way. And in fact, there are different ways to do these associations in memory. So one is really associating a face with a name, or a name with a face. Sometimes, you know, we remember one and not the other. So this type of associations. But another type of association is sequences of events. So for example, if you see a movie, so you are in front of TV, or I guess you don't watch TV anymore, you just watch things on YouTube and stuff, right? Anyway, so you see a movie, and it's a not very good movie, but you sort of watch it, okay? And then, I don't know, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years later, you run into that movie again by, you know, channel surfing. And what is likely to happen is, as you see the movie, you know what happened. Well, first you recognize you've seen this movie. So this is, you know, recognition. And then the associations in this movie are done between one scene and the next. So as you see the movie, you sort of know what's happening next. But usually you can't remember further than that. You have to see it to discover it, right? So this is another form of associative memory that is very strong. It's also how people remember to go from one place to another. You know, if I ask you to tell me how to go from where you live to here, you will, you know, relive the route, and you will try to explain to me how it is. And of course, as we were saying, repetition reinforces both memory and learning. So this number 7 plus or minus 2, there's a very famous article by a researcher called Miller that said the magical number 7 plus or minus 2, because he ran experiments to show that there are this limitation in our brain about memorizing about 7 items. And what he explains is that, in fact, using various tricks, you can actually go a lot farther by multiplying, you know, 7 items in one dimension with 7 items in another dimension. So using different types of perceptions, for example, or different things. And so this is a very often cited paper that identified this sort of limited ability of some aspect of our memory, but that we can in fact use to multiply this ability and make it possible to memorize very large amounts of things. And so now we move to what is it called? Action planning. Because again, this is something that has been well studied. How do people solve problems? So if, you know, when yesterday you had to come here for the first time, for some of you, how did you solve that problem? And one way to look at this is through Don Norman's action theory. And essentially what Don Norman has done is to identify a few steps that we go through when we try to solve problems. First, we have to identify the goal. And then we have execution phase here that is subdivided into 3 sub-phases. First, the intention, what it is I want to do to solve this problem. So, you know, I need to come to Orsay, so first I need to get on the train, then I need to find a bus, then I need to find my way on campus. So these are going to be sub-goals, and for each of these sub-goals, you can also subdivide them into smaller pieces. And so for each of the elementary pieces, you have the intention, I need to get to the metro. The specification of actions, well, to get to the metro, I need to get out of my house, I need to walk here and there, and then get down to the metro. And then there is the execution, which is to actually do it. So in this diagram here, we have a system down there, because this is the same thing that happens when you try to do something with a computer. You know, I need to write this report, so the first step is I need, you know, to launch the spreadsheet or the text editor. So that's the intention. So then I specify what to do. So I need to find the icon for Word and then double-click, and then I do it. And that's only when I do it that it actually gets processed by the system. And then you have the evaluation phase, where you look at if your action has done what you were expecting it to do. So, you know, if you're walking out in the street and suddenly the metro is not there, then you have a problem. So, but similarly, you know, if you don't find the icon you're trying to double-click, or you double-click and it doesn't launch. So in the evaluation phase, what you will look is first perception, gathering information, what it is I see, interpreting this information relatively to the goal, and then evaluate if you've reached the goal or not. And then if you reach the goal, then you can go to the next sub-goal. And if you haven't reached the goal, then your next task is probably to repair the problem, whether it's through a mistake of yours or something else that happened. Maybe you get to the metro and it's on strike, or they've closed down the station or something. So in the context of user interfaces, Don Norman talked about the execution distance here and the evaluation distance. And what he was saying is that if you look at systems that use command line input, both distances are really hard. You need to know a lot of things to go from the goal, I want to delete that file, to remembering to type a command and things like this. And you also need a lot of effort to understand what's happening. Because usually in command line interfaces, if things go well, it tells you nothing, right? And he compared that with graphical user interfaces, following the principles I discussed yesterday from Ben Schneiderman, saying, well, you know, it's easier to see the object and point at the object and select the object you want to act on. And similarly, when you perceive changes in the user interface on the screen, it's easier to understand what happened. So that's the notion of action theory. And it's one little thing in a lot of research that has been done on human problem solving. But this one is really, I'm showing this one because it's really tailored to human-computer interaction. And so problem solving, a lot of problem solving is fixing errors. And so what happens in case of an error is that you are here, so that's your current state, and your goal is here. So you're planning an action to get to that goal. So you're planning the action, you're executing the action, and then you are doing the evaluation phase, perception, etc., and you realize that you're not here, you're in that state instead, in the current state. And so then your next goal is going to be to fix the error, to fix the problem. And essentially, as people are more familiar with the system, they will move from the undo strategy to the repair to continue. So the undo strategy is, oops, I did something wrong, I need to get back to a known state and then try again. So this is very common, this is very frequent, this is what we are used to do, it's also the way we learn. But of course, it's not efficient. Well, first of all, there may not be a direct way to that goal. You know, if the metro is on strike, the metro is on strikes. but even if there is, it's inefficient to come back here before going here. So another strategy is to try to repair and to get to another state from where you will get to the goal. So, you know, if the metro station is closed, I'm going to try to go to the next metro station. So I'm doing a local repair so I can get back into a state I know. But the most expert people will continue and get to the goal through a completely different route. So metro is on strike, so I'll call a cab. Right? Now, for users to be able to use these different strategies, they need to have more and more sophisticated understanding of how the system works. I have to know that if the metro is on strike, it doesn't help to go to the next station. So all this knowledge is captured in what's called mental models. And the mental model is the representation in our mind of the real world and how the world works. So it's really our brain works on mental models. So if I ask you, you know, how you go from your home to here, you have a mental model of how things are. It may be distorted relative to reality, but if it works for you, it's good enough. And so what we spend a lot of time doing in our lives is creating these mental models, updating them, changing them, revising them. And we always solve problems relative to these mental models. So when I use a computer system, the first time I use it, I don't know much about it. And then as I use it, I discover things and I make theories about how it works. These theories build my mental models. And the mental model is a prediction machine. It helps me say, well, if I want to do this, probably I should, you know, do this action, and this is how it should work. And so when a system works well, it's because your mental model matches the actual model for the system. And when a system doesn't work, it's because your mental model doesn't match the one in the system. And this can happen for several reasons. One is because the system is poorly designed, so it makes you think it works like this, but it doesn't. It may be because you have other mental models that you try to apply because you use another similar system or something like this, and these other models makes you less effective at using a new system. So there are all sorts of reasons why you may run into problems, and some could be caused by the system itself, but some can be caused by your prior learning and knowledge. So that makes making systems that work for everyone extremely difficult, of course, because you cannot know in advance everybody's mental model and design for these mental models. And this is why also when we create new systems, we try to involve users as much as possible. And part of this is to try to understand what is their mental models of the tasks that we're trying to replace with another system. And if we're looking at a small audience of people, it's fairly easy. If you look at, I don't know, the way journalists are creating their articles, they probably have similar mental models. But if you're trying to design a system that is a text editor to be used by everybody, it's a lot more difficult because you cannot make all these assumptions. And people will run into more problems also. Okay, so I think that's it for this part of the course. Do you have any questions?
Yeah.
No?